Welcome to a somewhat belated week in sports cars on the Marshall Pruitt podcast, presented to you by Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers. Graham Goodwin, it is Friday, March 1st, and I am sure you, like many of us who love, compete in endurance racing, report on endurance racing, photograph it, do whatever, happened to wake up this morning and receive a barrage of... oh my gosh, what happened type shock at either a lack of inclusion on the final entry list for the 24 Hours of Le Mans or massive elation from those who did.
For those that are kind of catching up with this, this is the day. We've seen the final 14 cars allocated a place for the 2019 Le Mans 24 Hours. And as Marshall quite rightly says, a further 10 on the reserve list. Though reality, I think, is that few, if any, of those reserve listed cars are going to get an opportunity to go in this day and age. We see fewer and fewer cars falling off the perch. And it's fair to say there were some surprises in there. We were looking for an answer as to which way the ACO would go. Would they go with the GT Pro class, the GTLMs from the United States, from the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship, or would they edge further towards their own full-season ELMS, Asian Le Mans Series, LMP2 and GT cars of the GTM class? And the answer, very firmly, and with not a very clear reason why this was delayed, is that it's gone with the GT Pro cars. Every single car from the IMSA GTLM class that applied has got a place. They will form half of that final 14, seven cars, two Corvettes, two Fords, two Porsche, and the Rissi Competizione Ferrari, which in itself has caused a degree of the controversy of the day. We'll come to that one, I'm sure, a bit later. The other seven, all from the European Le Mans Series, with the two are GTM cars, the Duncan Cameron Spirit of Race Ferrari, was first reserve, I think, last year, or ended up as first reserve. The second Kessel Ferrari, which is one of two all-female crewed cars that was on the entry request list this year, but it's the only one there, and we'll come to that one a little later. The remaining five, all LMP2 cars from the ELMS. But in amongst that little lot, MP, there are some strong controversies, and I think it's fair to say none more so than a car that's not there.
Yeah, so again, we try to be impartial here or present things in an impartial fashion. At the same time, we also have brains. We also have the ability to look at things and say whether you can be as impartial as you want. Things that make sense or don't make sense have nothing to do with impartiality. If you can look at something and say, huh, that's a weird decision that I don't fully understand. I'd say looking at the Meyer-Shank Racing Jackie Heinricher all-female LMP2 entry that was meant to be served by the Algarve Pro Team, the fact that that effort, which was meant to be sponsored by Caterpillar, a Fortune 100 global company, I realize it might not be a brand name like some others, but it is actually a massive corporation. The fact that Caterpillar was behind this, ready to support this, the fact that I would say three of, not saying the three best, but three of the best women who compete in road racing on the planet were involved. Catherine Legg, first of all. I can think of few, if any, women that are faster or more skilled than Kat. Christina Nielsen, a two-time IMSA GT Daytona champion, and Bia Figueiredo, IndyCar and sports car veteran. This was meant to be their three-car all-female team, an extension of their season-long IMSA program in GT Daytona, representing Caterpillar, promoting this all-female excellence and achievement initiative. I realize that there was the counter to this. As you mentioned, there were two all-female entries, the second one being from Kessel Racing. Kessel being fortunate, having won the Le Mans Cup in the GT category, to receive an automatic invite in GTE AM. That's all very positive. There's nothing negative to say about that. I'll just suggest a few other things. Again, you might contemplate as to whether it's maybe a fully rationalized consideration. The automatic entry, well, Kessels would obviously be smart to accept that. They've already committed to a full season of ELMS with the three women that they have assigned to that effort. So once more, all very smart stuff. What I would just say, though, is if I'm thinking of Le Mans specifically, the biggest sports car race in the world, if not the biggest race in the world, with so many eyes looking in, so much international interest, GTE AM, with any entry, men driving, women driving, doesn't matter. It reminds me a lot of the former IMSA PC class, one where there were some stupendous teams, some great drivers, and it got about 14 seconds of coverage during a broadcast, if we were lucky. Pro-Am class, really just bottom among recognition. And I realize that GTE AM will garner more than 14 seconds during the 24 hours. But again, just trying to suggest that if we're talking about initiatives, an all-female program, I'm sure at some point there will be a special call-out to the Kessel Racing all-female entry for Frey, Getting, and Gossner. Just not sure if that call-out will be due to the team's highly competitive stance in the competition, in the actual motor race, Graham, compared to, hey, this is a unique thing, but there's no real reason to point out their actual position on track. Just suggesting that while LMP2 is certainly not LMP1 in terms of recognition and being featured in a broadcast, it's a lot higher on the register in the possibility. I'd also say that if we're trying to promote women in racing, a topic we touched on earlier this week, something we know that the ACO is we believe and hope is fond of, we know for sure the FIA is fond of, names of Catherine Legg, Christina Nielsen, Bea Figueiredo, certainly going to reach a wider audience just based on name recognition, but also from a competitive standpoint. Algarve, pretty darn good at what they do. Kat, Christina, and Bea also being very fast motor racing drivers. Just saying we might have a chance where that car could not only be mentioned as an all-female entry in the race, but might actually be up in a very strong competitive position just to be recognized for that and that alone. So, again, I'm not the ACO or FIA, obviously and thankfully, but I'm just trying to think of if I had an option to say, you know, what's one entrant that could actually make a pretty big impact in an important way? Seems like not only did they decline its entry, they went even further in speaking with Jackie this morning and Michael Shank, where they both said it's one thing to not get the invite, to be placed ninth on the list of 10 alternates. And on that, although they are ninth, next to last there, there are 7 P2 cars among those alternates, and they're last. So that, I think, was just an extra kick in the nether regions that really did not sit well. And with all that said, just a wrap. You could say, well, hey, they're on the alternate list. They're on the reserve list. Sure. Almost half of the LMP2 class would have to fail to turn up for them to get in. And as a result, Michael Shank confirmed that they did contact the Algarve team and said, don't hold a car for us. It ain't happening. We don't want to hold you back. So, yeah, just a little bit bizarre. But they're not the only ones with some grousing to do.
They're not. I mean, it is a real shame. A real shame. It would have been a great headline to have two all-female crews in two classes. Fairly uniquely, though, and for reasons I hope we can get into in questions, I'm certainly editorializing on it this evening. This is a bit of a low point, for anything other than the auto entries, the full professional entries, and the FIWEC's full season entries, because simply the numbers are incredibly tricky. The reality is that once you took out those 7 GT Pro cars, and very clearly that decision was taken to accept all of those cars, and that will be, amongst other things, for commercial reasons to the ACO, a relatively tiny number remained of spaces that were available for the ACO to choose that final seven. And you do the numbers. We basically were there with, before the 14, 46 entries to the 60 determined before today. Add in the final seven with GTE Pro cars. That means 53 were done. And we know that 75 teams or 75 cars were on that entry list. That means that we had seven from 22. Then that's not great maths. And the reality is that quite aside from the Meyer Shank racing car, and I would say this, in balancing, that is the, as far as I'm aware, the only IMSA car that has been rejected this season. I believe there were 10 that actually either were in there by way of an auto entry or through the GTE Pro class. Nine of those cars are actually on the full season entry list, which means that here's a bizarre one, MP. Other than the WEC, where the entry is contingent on getting a Le Mans place, the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship had the best record of getting cars through this year of any championship. Where we've got further woes are for the European Le Mans Series and their LMP2 class. Remember, 18 cars on that list for the full season for 2019. Of that 18, I'm just double-checking myself, something like 8 or 9 will be actually on the list, and three of those came as a result of winning the various classes just last weekend, or rather two of those, because one of them isn't full season entry in the European Le Mans Series, came with Asian Le Mans Series success. And it's from there that we get, if anything, an even bigger controversy on this list. And that comes courtesy of the fact that United Autosports, a UK-based team, but of course US-flagged team, gets one entry and only one entry, despite the fact they've entered, count them, 11 cars in three separate ACO series this year. And if my maths are correct, I think I'm right that either 6 or 7 of those cars won at least one race in their class in that racing. They suffer as a result of what is a clear policy this year, determined by the ACO to try to get as many different teams in as possible, that there is only one team that gets more than one car in LMP2. That is Jackie Chan DC Racing from the WEC, who got two full season entries, of course, but no other team gets a second car in LMP2. And for United Autosports in particular, and I've spoken a couple of times today to co-team owner Richard Dean, it is fair to say they are absolutely furious.
Happiest
about
man in the world today, Richard Dean and Zach Brown. Well, and I'll just throw this in real quick, and I know you're going to get to it, but I've had to offer the same explanation to a couple of other folks today who offered similar questions, and I won't mention who, but received a call from a very prominent team principal who actually, not in the LMP2 category, but in a different category competing at Le Mans, asking the same thing about United Autosports. And I wouldn't even position that person as a fan of the team or its owners, but did say, you know, ask something along the lines of, don't they put like 11 cars between ELMS, Asian Le Mans Series, Le Mans? I mean, again, you name all the things they do. Don't they put like a darn near a dozen cars? An exaggeration, but don't they essentially flood ACO and FIA-based competition with their entries, with their drivers, bringing sponsors, paying for tires? And I mean, just if we're thinking about an entrant in a completely neutral fashion, if all the names were stripped from who entered and you just saw the amount of vehicles and drivers and resources each team is pumping into ACO and FIA-based competition each year, you would just look at the huge wedge affiliated with this team and go, wow, those folks really are all in. They're a big, clearly, don't know who they are, but they're a big part of what's taking place with these sanctioning bodies. I'd assume they would be placed above, I'll leave it to you to call out some names, but there are one or two teams given LMP2 entries, Graham, that you go, really? Those guys can't even get out of their own way. So I'm just saying, if you're thinking where you might tilt you want to call it favoritism, or just rewarding those who invest in the ACO and FIA, Yeah, again, I had a team owner say, boy, I don't really like those guys, but I'm kind of blown away they got shafted like this.
Well, let's put those numbers into perspective for you. It is indeed, in ACO racing, 11 cars in 2018 were entered. Plus, let's not forget, two LMP2s at Daytona and an LMP2 for two of the three remaining NAAC races as well. So the reality is, overall, 13 entries in sports car racing in LMP2 and LMP3 in one single year. Let's go further than that. In the ELMS, two LMP2s, one of which won two races at the end of the season. Beyond that, two LMP3 cars. They are a previous LMP3 championship-winning team. And both those cars won races in the European Le Mans Series last year. Three LMP3 cars in the ELMS supporting Le Mans Cup last year, all three of which have got returning customers for United Autosports and therefore for the ACO. Then, at the end of the season, having not won a championship, they then committed, count them, four cars to the Asia Le Mans Series, came into the final round at Sepang in title contention for all three titles that they were contending, LMP3, LMP2AM, and indeed LMP2 in the overall. And at one point in the race, stood in a position where they could have taken all three titles, only to actually have misfortune hit two of the three cars concerned. Won the title in the Asia Le Mans Series. And here's the kicker. That's the position, that is the auto at the entry that they've got. They've not got an entry as a result of the remainder of their commitments. And as Richard Dean, I think, very eruditely, if slightly angrily, said to me a little earlier, look, if you look at the policy that's been followed here by the selection committee, there can be no doubt that coming into today, or coming into last weekend, United Autosports stood with an entry against their name. Effectively, what the selection committee has done here is said, okay, you've won that one, you can have that one instead. Not as well as, instead. That, to me, is massively wrong-headed. It is completely the wrong message about trying to encourage teams to take on additional programs across multiple championships, which in previous years has been a determining factor to gain an entry. This is just wrong, straight wrong. We've seen decisions before now by the eight selection committees that, you know, on the cusp, or maybe one or two that you've kind of thought that's wrong. In this case, Marshall, I'll call for what I see here. This is wrong. It actually stands to be very damaging indeed for future confidence from teams and drivers in the Continental and supporting series for the ACO. And I have to tell you, I think this needs a strong response from the ACO to get this one sorted. I have had calls, not just from Richard Dean, but from other LMP2 teams, telling them that some of their backers are saying, what confidence does this give me in adding, insert name of project, to our plans for this year and next year as we build towards what we want to do? This is, I have to say, massively damaging decision from the selection committee. I completely understand what it is they're trying to do to get as many teams as possible over the line and into the race. But I'm sorry, this one, guys, you got it wrong. You got it very wrong indeed. And I don't often like to endorse anger on the part of my sporting colleagues, but on this occasion, I have to tell you, Richard Dean is stone cold correct. Absolutely no way that team should not be there today with the two cars that they put into that entry firmly on the entry list. I'm not going to go down the road, MP, of pointing fingers and saying, should have been there for this car or that car. Every car in that entry has got things against their tick box, if you like, tick box list that actually would certainly warrant them being considered. But in this instance, I'm really sorry. It shouldn't always be the richest teams that actually get in. But in this case, it's not just about the money. It's about the application with this team as well. You know, remember, this is the team that brought Juan Pablo Montoya to the Le Mans 24 Hours. It's the team that brought Fernando Alonso to the Rolex 24 Hours at Daytona. It's wrong. It's just wrong. I will admit to being quite cross about it myself, not because I've got any investment whatsoever in that team, but simply because, frankly, I don't like having to second guess the reasons behind a decision that is made behind closed doors. I'm sure with the best of intentions, I'm sure there are other teams grateful for that decision, but in this case, I'm afraid the race is the poorer without that second car.
We are starting off the weekend sports cars with a grand soapbox moment from Graham Goodwin. I love it. I love it. I don't know if I'll say I'm playing devil's advocate because I'm about to counter my devil's advocacy, but you could say, hey, guys, all this should be coming back to the impartial. All of this should be blind. All this should be completely impartial. You mentioned that so many of the 60 entries are locked in via guaranteed automatic entries. So it is not truly 60 individual cases to weigh for the selection committee. We know that for a fact. Indeed, it's a relatively small prized number of case-by-case assessments. It's all decision-making compared to automatic. It's there, nothing to say about it. It's done deal. So, again, in theory, we should think of, or we might think of, the selection committee being impartial, being blind, saying, yeah, you're all female. Great. We got two. There's one that was an automatic entry, granted, again, in the class that tends to receive the least amount of recognition and coverage. But nonetheless, there were two. We chose one. We haven't ignored this taking part in this. Again, granted, is automatic. So the team, you know, that was not really call it a choice so much. But so you could say, hey, they've embraced this all-female initiative with Kessel, just not the other one. So let's not harp on the ACO or FIA. At the same time, you could say, well, were United Autosports fully invested in our big grand category, the WEC? Were they full season entrants? Are they currently full season entrants to receive the no question invites for, you know, or potentially additional invites? No. There's nothing that they have done to commit at the highest level. Great that you're playing in ELMS. Great in Asian Le Mans Series. Great that you've had success there. But maybe you should take a step back, feel yourself happens to be so precious. Now, again, that's just trying to present the cold black and white side of things. I understand. But again, I'm just saying, hey, who are you today? Who are you committed? What are you to us today? So that could be, again, you could easily push back and say, so with all that, Pruitt and Goodwin, shut up. There's nothing wrong here. I'll just maybe offer the fact that, yes, while that's true, we're adults. We're all adults, and we know that that is indeed not how things are done. We know that things are not done in a strict, cold, passionless, taking nothing else into account, just strictly making decisions with no feeling, no anything. We know that's not how things work, and I think that's where the frustration comes in. As I mentioned, if you were to look through the entry list in all four classes, you can definitely find some cars, some entries where you go, what are they contributing to the race? What value? Can we paint a few cars in every class and say, oh yeah, they're either going to be first out or just so slow that they're not even going to factor? Yes, we absolutely can. So we could then say, well, so if we're using any of the normal qualities you might attach, say speed, competitiveness, just overall aptitude, you can see that, yeah, that clearly has not been a factor involved in some of these decisions. You could also say, again, in theory, if you want to choose and think about what's best for the sport, you'd say, well, and I'll just close on this, Graham, who co-owns United Autosports? Well, that would be the man who is the CEO of McLaren Racing. That would be the person who has expressed interest in McLaren building and participating, building a car and participating in the upcoming hypercar class. Again, I realize these aren't the things that should be factored into who gets an extra invite or not, but we'd be silly to tell ourselves that these things are never factored into such things, or should not at least be considered. If the guy who co-owns probably the most invested in terms of overall vehicle count in ACO / FIA competition is also the man in charge, and in charge of the purse strings to highlight a very high-profile hypercar program, and you're telling Zach Brown and Richard Dean, meh, you get one. Again, I'm just saying, if you're looking big picture, beyond just what the 60-car entry list for 2019 represents, back to your point, I think there might have been some small, narrow focus applied to something that, you know, maybe has not or will not be remembered as being in the best interest of the sport. What I'd hate to see happen, and we would never be told, it'd never be acknowledged, Graham, but I would hate to learn that Zach and Richard end up souring on the concept of competing at a heavily invested level to where either they pull back or their sponsors or drivers pull back as a result of this decision. And Zach taking one step further saying, really? All right, well, hey, maybe this hypercar thing, boy, that'd be a pretty significant budget we attach. Maybe we go look at doing something else. Maybe we use that for a bigger IndyCar program. Again, I realize these things shouldn't matter, but I hate to say that these effects do at least impact those making the decisions on the team and manufacturer end. So if they weren't considered by the ACO and FIA and they were completely neutral, as they should have been, I can guarantee you that some folks at United Auto Sports are asking some very big questions about whether they should be looking with such starry eyes at future competition.
While you're kind of teeing up the first questions, I'll just add this. As a balancing fact here, this, I believe, is the low watermark for the ACO Continental Series and, for that matter, for anybody, any aspirant entrant for the Le Mans 24 Hours from the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Series. And there's several factors behind that. The big numbers we've seen in the Super season for WEC means that proportionately more places are taken up. This year in particular, we've seen an astoundingly high number of the auto entries for Le Mans taken up as well. And for less welcome reasons, it's also likely to be the high watermark for GTE Pro for some time to come, with the predicted end of the Ford program and the increasing likelihood of BMW going the same way. What all of that will mean, as things just die back into normality, is that there will be significantly more entries available for these full season entries elsewhere. Let's hope it's a happier time through what is, again, I'm sure, going to be a double edged entry list announcement when we get through to 2020's Le Mans 24 Hours. Time for questions, I think.
MP, yeah, we're going to take away sharp objects, so no anything. So let's do this. I know we closed the last episode by saying we were going to start off with fun and general stuff. It just feels like starting off. Actually, you know what? Coming off of a rather some heavy stuff here, why don't we do that? And then we're going to dive into some IMSA and then WEC, Asian Le Mans Series, ELMS, ACO, a little bit of general, and hopefully let you on your way for the weekend. So why don't I go ahead and kick off here? Grab one from fun. So yes, indeed, we're starting at fun, which I don't know if we've ever done that before. And again, we're just referring to the categories that DailySportsCar.com's Ryan Kish sets up for us. So the one titled fun, well, let's kick off here just because we kind of need a little bit of humor. Shay Adam, our good friend Shay Adam from Facebook, asks, what's the best line you've been told in an interview that you couldn't use? And she says, don't tell us who said it, and obviously we wouldn't. It's more fun that way. So do you have a line from someone, Graham, where you're like, oh, that's the best ever, but you've just told me it's off the record or similar?
Usually with good humor, but I've heard it several times, it would go somewhere along the lines of, and if that expletive deleted driver does it again, I'll put his expletive deleted into the expletive deleted wall. Somewhere along those kind of lines. We get it time and time again. I do like emotion in interview. I do like to see that people are actually alive rather than just giving me the same old, let's thank the sponsors. But there have been too many. There have been too many of blessed memory. Neil Cunningham, I'm afraid, fell victim to ill health, cut down in his prime. And Neil, an Australian driver, naturalised into the UK, was always good for an absolutely brilliant interview, particularly in adversity. And I always remember he was driving a Morgan in the Spa 24 Hours, which was suffering power difficulties. Thing kept cutting out. I think I'm right, lost power going up through Eau Rouge, was collected at very high speed from the rear by another GT2 car, which pushed the Morgan across the nose of the car. Door flew off, and he's going down the Kemmel Straight with a rather confused guy in a Porsche GT2 looking into a rather confused and slightly worried Australian sitting in effectively a wooden framed Morgan at some high speed before the two of them actually came to a halt. And Neil's description of that incident will live with me forever. There is an as yet unpublished book from Neil, and it would be good to see that one actually on the bookshelves for those people that love racing anecdotes. He was one of the best at it. He's my choice.
I think I've mentioned this before somewhere on a podcast, if not our own, maybe on someone else's. So in the off chance you haven't heard of it, I will strip names from it. This was back, I believe, 2008 or 9 at Petit Le Mans. It was a marquee driver, someone who was definitely among the most sought after among fans and whatnot on the entry list, who had been messed around with by one of the American Le Mans Series senior officials and was offering to do some PR, to do some press leading up to Petit Le Mans in exchange for a free parking space for his motor coach atop the hill. At the time, the ALMS, which granted, owners of the ALMS also owned the circuit at that time, they were charging drivers something like $5,000 for the event to park their motor coach. and so, yeah, that driver said, well, that's silly. Why don't we trade out, you know, I can do a press hit here or there for you, and let's void that bill. And so they agreed to that. And what came back was something along the lines of the need for that driver to go and spend, I don't remember the exact time, it was something like 5 or 6 hours straight of doing press in the greater Atlanta area. And if the driver in question is one where, knowing their profile, it was such a crazy over-ask for what was being given. It was one of those things where I'll sit down somewhere for a half hour. But anything more than that would be ridiculous. So not only did they ask for 5 or 6 hours, that driver then turned them down. And I might be giving away who it is, because when that driver turned them down, the official came back and asked if his brother, maybe his brother could do it instead, as if that brother was just an irrelevant person who all they seemed to care about was getting the last name there, not actually who it was. So not only was it an insult in the amount of time that was asked for, but then also making that driver's younger brother feel completely useless as essentially a throwaway second-tier option. So the quote that came from this unnamed driver, and I've done a really bad job of pretending I don't know who it is, gave the eternally awesome quote of the first name, fill in the first name of the official, is a C-O-C-K. And we have used that line dozens of times in the ensuing years. And the official that he's referring to no longer actually works in that capacity, but we see him in paddocks from now on, or various times. And every time I see the guy, Graham, that line, so-and-so is a C-O-C-K, that's all I think of when I see the guy. That line, exact, just boom, every single time. So, all right, let's go to a couple of more fun, then we're going to jump in.
I can weld two together here for you. And it's the gentleman, I always struggle with your name, Nick. Go on.
Dovbyniak,
that's way better than I could normally go for. I'm going to run that one together with Joseph Ostrowski, because Nick asks, at the start of the Asia Le Mans series, he misread DSC headliners. Collado joins Guy Fieri for Asia Le Mans series. Yellow Ferrari seemed very appropriate. What celebrity chef would you like to see join the sports car paddock? I swear Paul Hollywood did the Coda 12 Hours. He did. Bobby Flay strikes him as an AMG guy. And I'm going to run that into... Joseph's point from Facebook, do Inter Europol have the best livery in sports car racing today? I'm going to go for a name that probably means nothing to you, MP. Delia Smith, I think, would be a fabulous addition to the sports car racing paddock. But she would have to be part of the Inter Europol team. And by the way, yes, they do have one of the best liveries, but only when they remember to put the coloured wheels on the car. When it has normal black wheels on, it doesn't look nearly so fun. And for those that aren't familiar with Inter Europol, who will be at the Le Mans 24 Hours as a result of winning the LMP3 class in the Asian Le Mans series, it is front-end green, merged into rear-end yellow, and is beloved from followers of the European Le Mans series and being known as the Norwich City car, because that is the colours of Norwich City Football Club here in the UK. And Delia Smith is a director of the Norwich City Football Club and is known for a particular appearance on television where she was trying to encourage the fans to greater efforts in supporting the team. I suspect she put in the cooking sherry when she did it. But for me, Delia Smith, yes, Inter Europol, I think, have one of the very best of them. But there are some corking liveries on sports cars in the modern era. Particularly fond, I have to say, of the AMG at Bathurst this year, which was the Vodafone back car, the all-star car that featured three V8 supercar drivers. That car, I thought, looked absolutely splendid. But Inter Europol, great team, moving forward. You will see them this year if plans carry on the way they should in LMP2 for a couple of races, MP. They're planning to do Laguna Seca and Petit Le Mans with one of their two new Ligier P217 Gibsons. And you'll be able to see for yourself how good that livery is.
Well, that's a beautiful thing. Let's grab one more from fun, knowing that we've already posted an hour's worth of the week in sports cars this week. We're just going to use the word week a lot, covering what we thought the entry list would contain. Let's see. We already covered that one. We covered that one. Where else should we go? All right, here we go. This comes in from Adam Bowman, talking about Evo kits on a GT2 car. Why not? Here's a fun question. If you could build an Evo kit for one GT2 car from about 2004 to 2011 to allow it to be competitive today, which car would you choose? So what comes to mind? I mean, at least
TVR. TVR.
Ooh.
The TVR T400R. I know it was crap. But I loved that car, and I loved it because it was crap and because actually a couple of teams actually managed to squeeze the very best out of that. My best story about that car is the fact that in the early versions of it, originally called the Tuscan R, later the T400R, was that there was a handling imbalance. When that was investigated, it turned out to be because the chassis members were uneven one side to the other. And the reason for that is because it's got to be derived from a road car. And I believe there was only ever one road car for the T400R. And they realized they hadn't left space for a washer bottle. And so legend has it, they had to cut out one of the smaller chassis members in order to fit in the washer bottle. That's the level of engineering that used to go on in Blackpool in the UK. Fabulous, fabulous sounding and looking race car. And the fact that Team LNT managed to get one of those cars to a win, and in fact a win and second place in a Le Mans Series race at Spa, no less, is still a thing of wonder. As I'm speaking to you now in my little office at the bottom of the garden, I am looking at one of my most prized possessions, which is one of the winner's caps from that race with the six signatures on it. Fabulous stuff, and it would most certainly be the TVR.
I'm going to say something that's silly, and that is the Panos Abruzzi. and it's because it was a short-lived, ill-fated, expensive endeavor. The thing was ugly as sin. If, for those who've seen it, you're probably saying, Pruitt, I already thought you were dumb, but this is just taking things to a new level. I'm a firm believer that since this is strictly a great question coming in related to Evo kits, that if we could apply a proper Evo kit, as Adam is asking, to one of those cars, and I believe it was built in 2011, I hope I'm not off of my year, I firmly believe that if someone could have a real proper second crack at it and develop it with some sort of Evo-ness in mind, I think that car might actually not be too bad. So that's my thought, and maybe there's a little bit of nostalgia involved here, knowing that the good Dr. Panos has passed, and that was, if we're talking a true from-scratch design, not the Delta Wing that he was involved in afterwards, but a true, we came up with it on our own, and this is what we want to be successful with type road car and race car. The fact that his last effort, at least that I can think of, really was nothing close to being a success. I just think it'd be cool if someone, if there was this fantasy-based ability to go back in time and apply a full Evo thing to the car. All right, I'm going to jump us quickly into General, because I think we can get through General pretty quickly and close on both IMSA and WEC here, if that is all right with you, my good man.
Of course.
As I do my best to get the final vestiges of this COTA muck out of my lungs. Let's go to General. Got a question here that I just thought was interesting. Came in from David Faulkner via Facebook. He says, what has happened to the, quote, Yak Attack? Referring to Colombian race car driver Gustavo Yakiman. I heard a whisper that after the Laguna Seca Mazda clash in 2018, he was, quote, asked to leave the team. Clearly fast and talented, however, in need of some further training / coaching. Any news on where or if he is driving this year? Can you answer the latter portion, Graham? Because I haven't followed, because I'll admit I stopped caring.
I have to say, not seen his name anywhere for the current season. That's a shame. Never mind.
Really? All right. I'll just look. I'm being honest. That's what we try and do here. I do not dislike Gustavo by any means. I like the kid. Always liked the kid. And I've probably been someone who, while many were possibly very rightly so, questioning whether he deserved to be in professional racing vehicles. I know his Grand Am Daytona prototype introduction was a crash-happy competence questioning endeavor, that being with Michael Schenck Racing, actually. He was someone who ran into a lot of things and seemed to have an attitude about it. Never made a mistake in his life. Always the fault of the other person. And I guess I'll say that I was definitely not as ready to write him off as some others were. Not saying that my decision was accurate, just wanted to give him a chance. For that kind of rope, it ran out at Laguna last year, as you mentioned, David. So I don't know where he's been. Again, I enjoy the kid in just on a personal level, but as a race car driver, if he is not competing professionally in sports car racing anymore, other than the potential money he might bring to a team, I don't really see that as a loss. And yes, I do know for a fact, because I was told, even though he disputes it and his father disputes it, I was told by the team 2 days after he, while two laps down, took out the race-leading Mazda. The team said, we are doing everything we can to make sure that he is never driving this car again. They positioned his lack of completing the season at Petit Le Mans due to funding shortage or some other, quote, budget-related thing, which is great. I mean, we see those, you know, it's the same thing, Graham, like we read in a press release when the manufacturer says, oh, our, you know, we fell out of the race due to an electrical failure. the part they don't tell you is because the piston shot out the side of the block and severed the wiring loom. But again, you can paint it, dress it up as, oh, it was an electrical failure. Same kind of thing here. So granted, he may have been told, they may have said, oh, budget, we're short. Sorry, man, we can't run you. Anyways, that's what I know. Not sure if we're going to see him back. Maybe taking some time away, David, would be a good thing, because he does have talent and he can
be
quick. But the actual getting to the checkered flag without hitting other cars, that maybe is not some an aptitude that he demonstrated to be moving in the right direction year after year. I'm going to take one more here because it's something that I have specific knowledge of. Graham comes in from Kevin Frederico on Facebook. He says, is Greg Pickett done with racing anything? He said they tried the unified IMSA series and left and talked about IndyCar. Did the Muscle Milk sale? Greg is a person who founded and owned the Muscle Milk brand, and all prospects for future endeavors. He has actually been competing in, I think, more of a West Coast Trans Am type series.
Yep.
Kevin, and Greg, someone who just lives right over the hill from me. I am long overdue in returning a call to him, but yeah, I'm hoping to not only catch up with him, but also to record one of our My Racing Life and Career podcasts, because this is not only a great guy, but just has led a fascinating life. So still competing at frickin' 70-something years old, just not on kind of the high-level, call it readily televised stuff we've seen him in the past. So what are the one or two other generals you think, Graham, we should take?
Let's have a quick look. Chaz Mostert. Adam Smith from Facebook says, hey guys, thanks both for the efforts, put great products on the airways every week. I've read that BMW is trying to get Chaz Mostert full time. Would that deal be for their new prototype they're developing? And along that line, how hard is it for GT drivers to make the jump to prototype racing? Chaz, I watched Chaz in his early days with BMW in the Asia Le Mans series, and a very good driver he was too. Made a bit of a name for himself there, jumping into the car after the AM driver got out, having had other pro drivers start, and then basically pulling back a minute and a half, 2 minutes over his double stints in a four-hour race through that season. He's a very good driver. Wasn't at all surprised to see BMW pick him up for a number of other opportunities, including he did the Macau race. Did he do the Macau race? He did one of the one-off races for BMW. My understanding is that the principal program they're looking for him to join them for is an expanded factory effort in GT3 customer racing, of course, with factory talent injected into that, because he's got proven ability at that level. I don't think any decisions have been made so far about prototype program. Frankly, first one being, do they do it, let alone who's going to drive it if and when they do it, and whether or not it would be a factory effort or a customer car. Let's wait and see, but certainly I hope young Chaz can be part of that one, because I think he's a fine driver, a very fine driver indeed.
Feel the need to announce here, Graham. Well, first of all, feel the need to announce that we have awesome partners in Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers. I also feel the need to announce that possibly the greatest honor to date for me on social media has just taken place on Twitter. I was just followed by Golfing Bigfoot. Yes. Whose bio
Golfing
says...
Golfing Bigfoot is following you.
Whose bio says, legendary creature seen only by rednecks. Friends with the aliens trying to get in your brain. By the way, I have a sombrero. So it is indeed
Bigfoot. Is that Gustavo Yakima?
He might be listening to our recording right now. So, all right, where else should we go in Hegeneral before we move on to our final two categories of IMSA and ACO FIA World?
Well, let's have a final one from Nick, I can't say your name, from Facebook. Why don't we see North American OEMs playing in the customer racing scene beyond GT4? I think the Ford GT or Corvette GT would be a good fit. Are the manufacturers stretched too thin as it is? Could we see the C8R of a similar setup as the Aston Martin that can be converted between GTE and GT3 spec relatively easily? Well, we have seen US manufacturers in GT3 racing and with success in the past, particularly Dodge Chrysler, one of the very early adopters of GT3. That car came back in a completely different iteration and had some success in IMSA, but did not pick up the numerous customers that it would require. Ford have had a few cracks at GT3, either with the previous iteration of the Ford GT or indeed with the Mustang, with, again, pretty limited customer success through their technical partners. But yes, I think it would be great to see that. Callaway, their Corvette, by the way, was hearing some interesting stuff about a potential program for one of those cars. Keep an eye out for that one. In the relatively near future. But Callaway, at the moment, in terms of their numbers, stand likely, one of the most likely to be fall victim of the part of the homologation that says you must produce 10 cars in the first year, 20 cars in the second year of homologation. Otherwise, boys, you're not going to be GT3 anymore. But that is a fabulous looking and sounding piece of kit. And it would be great to think that they can find many more customers to keep that rolling along. But interesting, isn't it? Let's see what our good friends at Multimatic might pull out of the parts bin and come forward with, should a GT3 program be the right way to go to follow on from what is looking at the moment to being a fairly high-profile effort in GT4 with the Mustang.
We're going to flip a virtual coin. Do we go IMSA or do we go ACO and WEC as our penultimate category?
Let's crack on with some IMSA questions because it's short and sweet sojourn with IMSA this week.
That's the way commonly refer to Juan Montoya, short and sweet.
I'm going to crack on here with Jamie Bender, who asks, any word what Christina Nielsen might be driving this year? I thought I saw a picture of her sitting in the MSR NSX at the Sebring test. I think you did. Will she be doing anything else in IMSA in 2019? Oddly enough, and for reasons that are obvious from the conversation we've already had about the Le Mans 24 Hours, and that's MSR LMP2. I've actually spoken to Christina very recently, and I can tell you there will be multiple announcements as to what she is going to be doing in the very near future. I ask for your patience. She's asked for mine, and I think we'll be hearing things in days rather than weeks about what that talented young lady will be seen peddling through 2018. Matt Nidiat from Facebook. It's a second time around for Matt, and for anybody that doesn't get us to pick it out the hat, do ask again, because we will get around to them. On the IMSA private test schedule, Core is shown as bringing their DPI to VIR in June. Last time he checked, VIR was GTLM GTD only. And Matt says, through your excellent Beyond the Sports Car Paddock podcast, learn that Jeff Brown is an incredibly crafty guy. So what's he up to with this test? What does he hope to learn at VIR and apply to some other track? Why not just test another track instead?
Well, I'd say, and I'm completely guessing, and if I was really smart, Matt, I would have posed this to Jeff before we recorded. But I would say, first of all, very close to the team's base would be number one. And also the track's rolling nature, I would say, would be, if we're talking on the DPI side, you would certainly be able to learn many things that applied at many of the high-speed rolling road courses that they head to. That would be the two things that came to mind for me. I mean, obviously, with Core facilitating Porsche's factory GTLM entry, as you mentioned, there'd be great things to learn there with their Porsche 911 RSRs at a test. But if we're just talking about heading there in June, I haven't seen the exact date, but knowing what is coming in terms of the calendar in June, you'd be able to look at Watkins Glen being June 30th. Obviously, you have Mosport/Canadian Tire Motorsports Park on July 7th. You have Road America on August 4th. I don't know if I'd fit Monterey into that, but even Petit Le Mans towards the end. Just saying, if you're wanting to up or improve or just learn a lot with any car and you're going to almost half the season from June forward is going to places at a relatively high speed rolling type circuits, VIR would be a pretty darn good place to go to learn and get yourself studied up since, and again, I'll have to reread the exact rules, but most series have some form of verbiage preventing teams from going to a track somewhat soon before the proper motor race is held there for those cars. So, at least trying to pretend to be Jeff for a moment, I like the idea of this. Sounds pretty smart to me.
Perfectly fine. We keep coming around to Nick Dobaniak, and is IMSA planning on adopting the next round of LMP3 regulations for their prototype challenge? Didn't see it listed as one of the series set to be adopting them, just the ACO series. Is that an oversight in the press release, or are they going to carry on for a little while the with the older cars to save cost? Well, the reason it wasn't mentioned is because, of course, IMSA is not an ACO series. An ACO will determine what they're going to do with their associated series, although there is a problem beginning to emerge for the Asia Le Mans series. It's something discussing with a number of teams at Sepang that because of the way in which that calendar is now organized, that's going to give some problems for teams. Well, either having their cars on the wrong end of the world whilst everybody else is testing their updated cars, or trying to find a solution to running new cars in Asia. As for IMSA, my guess is they'll want to adopt the new cars as soon as possible, but that is for them to determine what's going to happen with their stakeholders, their teams, and for them to make that announcement, not have it made for them by the ACO. But that's the reason why it was in that press release, because it ain't their championship.
Aww. But
what catches your eye?
I would say, knowing that LMP3 has been a longer established entity in Europe than it has been in North America, I think you're spot on here, Graham. Again, we're having to read the proverbial tea leaves, but I think that since LMP2 purchases are still something that are very fresh for most teams here, and also the fact that the category is taking off, at least by what we happen to witness at the opening round at Daytona, yeah, of course, we would expect IMSA to move to next-generation LMP3 rules at some point. But at least for us over here, these things are still somewhat fresh, somewhat new, and at least for a feeder series, these LMP3s aren't cheap. They're cheap if we're talking compared to buying a full LMP2 car or otherwise, but they are not inexpensive. And beyond that, Graham, we know that at the feeder series level, those teams are not the ones operating with a ton of capital. So at least using IMSA's general guidelines for how they treat their paddocks, plural, they tend to look at things like this and say, great, they've announced a new thing in Europe where this category formula or otherwise stems from. We're going to hold on to this current formula for a couple of extra years because we cannot afford to have teams buying brand new versions of these cars, you know, every 2 or 3 years. So I would expect the current LMP2 models to be around for a little bit longer just because they're comparatively new to us.
Okay, we're running through these ones. Question for Marshall from Chris Humphries on Facebook. Now IMSA have uncapped the DPI class, they're setting quicker times. Should we expect this to continue for the rest of the season? Will be interesting if much changes at circuits like Long Beach, I presume you mean street circuits, with less of a lap time difference from the DPI and the GTLMs than other circuits.
Absolutely, Chris. Primary thing that we have seen, we have had drivers tell us about across almost every class. I know you've asked about DPI. From DPI down to GTD, even the LMP2s, I've heard the number float between 75% and 90% of the lap time improvements we've seen so far this year in the move from Continental to Michelin being down to tires. So with no substantive changes to DPI for 2019, other than not being bound BOP-wise, slowed down BOP-wise to LMP2. Yeah, cars definitely have a little bit more power. There's a little bit more natural performance within the vehicle as it is constructed, as it is built. But it just seems like if we're looking at the reasons why we would be, and we will continue to see new lap records set, I would imagine, everywhere with the DPIs, it will be some, or by and large, down to the Michelin tires, not IMSA just uncorking the DPIs to crazy new levels of performance. So I'm also confident that if IMSA did want to just really say, all right, there's nothing, we're not doing anything to slow down the DPIs, we could be going much faster as well. So at least for right now, definitely going to be going quicker everywhere. Put it down to those Michelins. And who knows, if we're lucky, Chris, maybe one day IMSA will say, let's let these vehicles just do whatever they do and everyone else be damned. That would make me feel so, so happy.
I'm going to take one more from the IMSA squadron here. Comes from Ian Gent. With IMSA's 50th anniversary, we're seeing a lot of retro liveries being raced. Is a livery choice purely down to the individual team, or does the manufacturer have to approve a livery before it can be applied? I think if we're talking here about customer teams, because clearly if it's a manufacturer-backed team, of course, they'd be part of that process. But this is their car. It's their property. They can do whatever they please with it. We'll add just this, by the way. We did see some years ago for, I would say, a one or a two-off, the renowned, and I use that term in its literal sense, the renowned livery for the Mazdas in IMSA racing for a brief period of time. And for long and tedious reasons, I came across the just a little, this was the 1991, by the way, Le Mans winning livery, another iconic sports car racing livery, that the rights to that livery are not owned by Mazda. They're actually owned by the sponsor. So that when any promotional car, whether it be road car or race car, is undertaken by Mazda, they have to seek specific approval and sign off for the way in which they've applied that livery to whatever vehicle it is, from the initial sponsor that owns the rights to that livery. There may very well be others in the retro catalogue. So that's my answer for that one, MP.
That tells me we need to close this week's show on your particular backyard, that being Weck Aslam Elms ACO, the world of ACO and FIA motor racing in the sports car category. Let's see. James Counter says, Graham, what is your highlight from the just recently, days ago, completed Asian Le Mans Series season? And what is your biggest lesson or takeaway from the season? Keep up the great work and get some rest, the both of you. So, as the world's leading Asian Le Mans Series reporter, commentator, you name it, give us the scoop.
It's been a good season. It was definitely a big step forward for the whole package. It was great to see some drivers whose talents may be a bit more masked in European competition to step forward. Step forward, by the way, Anders Fjordback from High Class Racing in the LMS, but joined Algar Pro and showed really well in amongst the top pros we had in the Asia Le Mans Series this season in his stints behind the wheel of the Ligier Judd. Also Darren Burke in the ARC Bratislava Ligier, another man whose name came to the fore and produced what became a title winning run for that team. We'll take Mira Konopka, who I'll again repeat, I've for the first Asia Le Mans Series ever gone through the entire calendar without seeing Miro in his pants in the garage, which is, by the way, I mean pants in the UK sense, not in the US sense, which frankly is a relief to me. But we've had battles in each of the classes. LMP3 with the Inter-Europol guys fending off challengers from United Autosports, and latterly from Ikuri Akos Nielsen as well, brought some great racing in LMP3. We've had some good racing at the front as well in P2. And towards the end of the season, with the TSRT team in their Audis, get out there and playing hardball with the two World champions pedalled Ferraris as well. So a really big step forward. I hope that momentum can be maintained into next season with a very different look to the calendar, with the newer Gibson engine LMP2s at the sharp end. Let's see what it can produce.
I'm going to go to Alex Eichmiller. Coming back to a person that you and I are both fond of and a topic that is good fun. Will the evolving conversations about what hypercar might end up looking like have any effect on Jim Glickenhaus participating? Any risk of them going in a direction that Jim might not be pleased with?
It's a really, really good question, and I wish I had a better answer than I've got, Alex, which is I have an inkling as to what is going on. There are clearly conversations going on designed to massively chop back the actual rather notional cost of the hypercar formula. There's been a couple of pieces written of late, principally by Gary Watkins, Autosport's renowned sports car reporter. Also Markus Schürig, Automotor und Sport in Germany, looking to unpick what he says is the hype around hypercar. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. The reality, I think, at the moment is this thing's on a knife edge. There is one thing that I would say about what we are going to hear next. I got a note from a very good friend within the process within the last few days that confirmed that the next point at which we should hear about where things stand with the new regulations will be in Sebring week. Now, I'd ask you, MP, if you were going to deliver bad news, would you do it there?
If I were going to deliver bad news, I would deliver it personally. And I would not, well, granted, you would not want to do that at an event because there are some of those really pesky and annoying reporter types who either get wind of news coming and then go and ask team principals, or team principals, as we learn, occasionally ring up or request the presence of those pesky reporters to come vent and air their frustrations, quite often unattributed, off the record, don't put my name on it, but here's what I think. There's no real easy way, I guess I would say, Graham, that of course you don't want to have this be a headline at, in this instance, what is a new venture at Sebring. The WEC coming back to America wasn't a long pause. Obviously, it was obvious, very recent appearances at Circuit of the Americas. But yeah, with this big combined dual event on not just American soil, but actual IMSA-controlled soil, something where this is the Daytona NASCAR-related Sebring-owning, controlling entity, I don't know if that is the place where I'd want to necessarily propose these things, some sort of setback, reveal these things to teams. If I could, I would do it after. And I realize that it's not as convenient because you do not have the entire paddock sitting there that can come to you and to relay that information. But if there are problems or there are setbacks, I'm just thinking in terms of crisis management, something you've told us you know a lot about between your former practice as a stripper.
Absolutely.
This would be done by phone, in person, or otherwise after the event so that any storms would not be overhead in Florida.
Should just add, by the way, the question was about whether or not some of these potential changes might affect Jim Glickenhaus and his program. I'll have a fairly extensive piece about Glickenhaus in the next couple of days on DSC. But just to clarify what that's about, the Gary Watkins story in particular did offer the opinion, the view that there was some pressure on the ACO to adopt potentially a change in philosophy for the hypercar program that could accommodate potentially both prototype based cars and adapted road going or track only actual hypercars. I think that's a massive stretch, bearing in mind that what we've been told all along, amongst others, by the Dr. Ulrich, who's the permanent consultant at the ACO nowadays, that such vehicles would just be way too expensive to kind of maintain a multi-year race program for. So let's wait and see what comes next. Either way, I sense a disturbance in the ACO force on this one. Things clearly have not gone in a linear fashion since last we were briefed in October.
Been hearing the same. Been hearing that we might, that whether it's the entrance or media or who knows, I've been hearing, I know you've been hearing for weeks that there could be some form of Sebring briefing. Also, yep. Just close this subject, at least for this week. It does tend to come up more often than we would like. I don't think I'm saying anything strange or out of the ordinary by mentioning we really don't want to hear anything negative. We don't want to hear anything about setbacks. I would hope most would be in agreement and thinking the same thing. But, I mean, truly all we want, you and I want to hear, can't speak for others, positive news. Things are coming together. We've had three manufacturers sign up for Hypercar. Not telling you who, but we have three confirmed. What, you name it. We have these positive things moving forward. Here are some adjustments that have made. We might have announced this for the rules. After further consultation, it's going to be that. We just want to hear positive things.
I would have wrote
this
that.
Is right around the corner. This is
absolutely.
We would be saying the same kind of semi-nervous, where are you guys going, where are things at, if this was for the 2021 introduction of Hypercar. I realize we're just now into March, but it's already feeling a little too late for 2021. I know if we're talking in terms of super seasons, that anything that would be released for this this new Hypercar formula would come after the completion of the next super season. Regardless, it feels like, boy, we're late to the game for 2021, but no, this is coming next year. So, as you said, a roadmap. What's going on? What changes have you made? Even if we in the media don't hear about it, please just tell us. Manufacturers have clear, concise information to make decisions. I know that speaking with Zach Brown from McLaren a week ago or whatever, in the quotes that he gave me, they don't have them. They'd like them. They're hoping to get them, but they don't have them yet. So we just love to hear this tension has been relieved.
Absolutely agree. As I'm fond of saying in a number of meetings about a number of subjects, where's the plan? And a plan is more than just regulations. It needs some corners around it. That's what we want to see. I want to walk out of the next conversation I have with someone in the know and in a position to influence the way forward. I want to walk out there with confidence that it's going to be delivered, and it's going to be delivered reliably, and it's got significant players to back it. We need to know, and we need to know soon.
All right, going to grab one or two final questions and then say farewell to this episode. Let's see. All right, this comes in from Robin Crickman. I'm not sure if we've had a question from you before, Robin. If so, I apologize. And if not, welcome to the show. Robin asks via Facebook, it would seem that Brendan Hartley has chosen to return to sports car endurance racing enthusiastically with drives in both Sebring Racings. Where do you think he may end up driving at Le Mans this year? That's also a good question if there's no Ferrari Formula One test simulator driving obligations to keep him from doing so.
Absolutely. Well, Brendan has currently got confirmed drives and publicly confirmed drives for, you're quite right, both Sebring races with Action Express and with SMP Racing. He'll race as well at Spa in the WEC race for SMP Racing, and will be replaced with Jenson Button coming back for the Le Mans 24 Hours. You may have read stories elsewhere in the media around the drive that Brendan has been signed for the Le Mans 24 Hours. I believe those stories to be accurate. I think we will see Brendan Hartley in an LMP2 car for the Le Mans 24 Hours. Beyond that, let's wait and see. Can't wait to see him again. It's been too long. He's been obviously behind the high barbed wire fence with barking dogs, searchlights, and high-powered electricity that is the Formula One paddock. It'll be great to see him wandering around with his unique hairstyle at Sebring, and hopefully we can see the characteristic smile of the very rapid young Kiwi. I hope we get to see him coming back out to play more often in sports cars. Remember, he is still a Porsche signed factory driver. Might that mean that some Formula E is in the future for young Mr. Hartley? Hope for, so for his career's point of view, but I equally selfishly hope that he can find a berth for at least some of the big races in sports cars around the world as well.
I will take one question that's a little bit more up my North American alley. Hopefully that doesn't come across as a dirty statement. And then I'll throw one back at you to close, my friend.
Perfect.
Our pal Stathis Coco sends in one for me via Facebook saying, MP, how's the relationship between IMSA and the ACO with Sebring and its doubleheader coming up? Will the event improve the relationship? I think from a practical standpoint, Stathis, I don't believe it's going to do much of anything in terms of improving or harming the relationship. We think about, you know, what is happening here. It's more of a infrastructure and event promotion collaboration done between the track and both series. Again, having mentioned just a moment ago that NASCAR/IMSA is the one that indeed controls Sebring, but this isn't so much IMSA and the ACO being hand-in-hand running a race together. It's two associated and affiliated organizations having their own independent events to run, and whether it's moving in different teams into race control, whether it is the track side support folks moving things, making any adjustments between sessions to fit the cars, I think it's going to be a little bit more on the ground level from a relationship standpoint than truly the high ups just getting possibly closer or more distant as a result of this combined thing. I can say this. We do hear the things that creates distance between the two, in particular this well-known multi-year thing now about Hypercar being a unique ACO WEC venture and not going down the road of IMSA's chosen DPI. We've had IMSA president Scott Atherton offer quotes, Graham, even somewhat recently, I believe recently as Daytona, that, hey, of course, we're open, we'll listen to, we'll see what they eventually come up, see whether we should adopt it or not. I don't believe there's anyone in the IMSA paddock that believes that will ever happen.
Yep,
and also
agree.
Among the DPI manufacturers that are already spending, although DPI is not super expensive if we compare it to anything that the ACO and FIA are planning to do today or are planning to do in the future with the top tier prototype class, it's still well beyond the comfort zone of the manufacturers involved in DPI. So I don't see any way how those things ever come together. And so just say the thing that separates is this DPI hypercar thing. And I don't think holding a race together is going to change that in any capacity. I also don't believe that we're going to see anything there change fundamentally. So if this can just be something that gets pulled off and helps IMSA in some way, and money is brought in, and it will, there'll be money brought in being generated by this NASCAR/IMSA-owned thing, then great. If anything, Stathis, I just look at this combined event as something that will possibly just be a financial positive for this American sports car racing organization without any real expectations for any other initiatives to advance or retreat. So let's go to a final question. And this one, it's stuck to one driver particular. well, I should say one driver in particular, but asking why, this comes in from Jacob Beam, who provided us some very kind pronunciation guidelines for his name. Second time Jacob has asked, he says, we've only seen one driver per car nominated in all of the ELMS entries so far. When can we expect full lineups to be revealed? Graham Goodwin.
The answer is, hi Jacob, the answer is as we move towards the start of the season, we are beginning to see those full driver lineups confirmed. The reason you only saw that is because that is what the teams are told they have to do in registering a full season entry. So it is a requirement of the entry to put just one driver name. There are clearly requirements in the various classes for the rankings of those drivers on the FIA driver ranking scale. But you will start to see increasingly, I think, the news coming forward of just how those 41 cars that are confirmed for the European Le Mans Series, but yet to see, by the way, the Michelin Le Mans Cup full season entry, how that will come forward. There is a second part to this one from Jacob, who asks, what do I think caused Inter Europol to separate Kuba Szymański and Martin Hipper, the former going to their P2 effort, their new P2 effort, the latter staying in P3? The answer there is very simple. It's all going to be to do with finance. Martin is an engineer by trade, although very rapid in a P3 car, but also serves as the driver coach for that team, and a very effective driver coach he's been as well. He'll be helping to bring forward some new blood for Inter Europol as Kuba, job done for those two as the Asian Le Mans Series champions, as Kuba moves on to LMP2. And I can tell you, watch this space. They're talking to some very interesting names indeed for that program.
I believe, my friend, we have just put the final touch on our week in sports cars for March 1st. We kicked it off with a Graham Goodwin, MP to a smaller degree, but a Graham Goodwin soapbox moment, rightfully so. I know that you are, speaking of finishing touches, putting those on an opinion piece about the decisions made and possibly some of the oversights or errant practices employed to come to those 60 cars that will be coming up here shortly on dailysportscar.com. So would seriously urge folks to read that, because Graham and a soapbox, one of the finer things in life. Thank you, my friend. I hope that the coming days are less contentious, and maybe we'll see. But hopefully next week's show is just rather boring and straightforward and nobody's super unhappy. But there's always time. Well, we've got World Challenge in action at Circuit of the Americas. We have Trans Am's season opener at Sebring, so we'll have some fun stuff to get to, plus a new episode of Inside the Sports Car Paddock. So I look forward to hearing who you get a hold of and grab some interviews with. And I already have a couple of folks lined up on my end.
I'm hoping to get some happy people and some maybe less happy people about the Le Mans entry list in the next couple of days. Let's wait and see how that one actually goes. Another great bunch of questions from you guys. Thanks for keeping them rolling in. We'll get to as many as we possibly can of every single week, of course. We've got, a week at home, which is going to be a lovely thing, with one exception, and that is the British GT Media Day, and we'll bring you some highlights from that, I hope, next week's show. But for now, from me, have a good evening, have a good day, have a good week, and we will speak to you, hear from you, and, speak right back to you on the Weekend Sports Cars next week.
Presented to you by Cooper Tires and the Justice Brothers.